guess what? The majority of the American people believe we should have a gold standard, not a paper standard.
Pink fluffy unicorns dancing on rainbows. Pink fluffy unicorns dancing on rainbows.
I gotta tell you, I miss Ron Paul. As crazy as he was, I missed him. But you may remember us talking the other day about big government versus small government. You know, the conversation I had over at the pizza shop with a couple of people who were just all in favor of and fuming. We need smaller government, buying into that right-wing frame. Well, it appears that that same kind of fear-mongering, of giant, overreaching, overburdensome, suffocating government, a little bit has found its way into the Democratic presidential primary. And as you may remember, Hillary said during the Nevada debate that Bernie, the proposals that he wanted to pursue, reasonable college education, or free, in his view, college education, single-payer health care for all, that would increase government by 40%. Other establishment Democrats have said 50% or even higher. And look, my position's always been the same. I big government, small government, doesn't matter to me. I want effective, efficient government doing the will of we the people. And you look at the current climate. We the people are being shut out. Self-rationing of health care, enormous student loan debt. You can go down the list, a lack of security and retirement, all that stuff. We got some real problems. But here to talk about this latest little bit of the big government talk on the Democratic side, I've asked our good friend Mateus Fernango, professor of economics at Bucknell University, to come talk to us. Also does a great blog, nakedkeynesianism.blogspot.com. That's where you go for that. Mateus, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So here we have this moment, where the Democrats, and you got Hillary running around saying, I'm a progressive, kind of pushing that right-wing frame of smaller government.
Yeah, or at least that we cannot possibly envision a more effective government, as you said, one that actually provides things that are part of what other countries, other developed nations have, a relatively accessible education, coverage for health for everybody, and, sort of slightly different ways in different places, but, essentially for everybody, that is somehow an utopia, and that the best we can hope for is to preserve what we have. And on top of that, also some sort of notion, particularly coming from the commentators. The New York Times had a piece on this. And all of these are economists, people that worked either for the Clinton administration or the Obama administration, people like Austin Goolsbee from the University of Chicago, or Paul Krugman in the New York Times, or Brad DeLong at the University of Berkeley, who worked for the Clintons back in the 1990s. All of them suggesting that these proposals by Bernie Sanders are not serious. So Krugman compare them to unicorn, and Ezra Klein, the Vox, this website, well-known journalist who was cited in the New York Times as a left of center economist, basically saying that Bernie's programs are flying puppies and other sort of cuddly, fuzzy, sort of dreams. Pipe dreams, basically. And I think that's very dangerous. The notion that we have to accept, Obamacare is good, and I'm for Obamacare, and nothing else
to start.
We should keep it. But let's remember, Obamacare was designed by the Heritage Foundation, the foundation funded by Mr. Coors, the beer billionaire, and that's their plan, because it fuels the pockets of the private, health providers. And so the notion that that's the best we can hope, and that that any sort of idea of health care for everybody, which, by the way, as Sanders always says, at this point we have 29 million Americans that are not covered. So in the wealthiest country in the world, we have, and that includes children, we have 29 million people that have no access to health care, that they have to go to an emergency room. So that's absolutely unacceptable. And the notion that it's utopia to have it, it's based on two things. It's based on the one hand, it's fear-mongering, as you were suggesting. It's the notion that, let's not rock the boat, Because a lot of these, so-called serious Democrats, I mean, for Austin Goolsbee, he's saying this. He's at the University of Chicago. He's an advisor to hedge funds. Their interest, their vested interest is within the Democratic Party, too. So the notion that there is this, I think, incorrect notion that we don't have to fight within the Democratic Party, or there is a mistake and these things should not even be brought to the table. And I should say Hillary has moved. So Hillary was for TPP. She's now against TPP, and part of the reason is that she has a contender from the left. So it's an important thing to have these things. And just one thing, to remember, it's not utopia. Canada has health care for everybody. England has health care for everybody. And it's not an impossible thing. It does cost a little bit more, but not as much as they would say. So the size of the government in England is about 5% more of in terms of spending. The U.S. spending is about 35% of GDP, all the levels of government. And for England, it's about 40%. So we're not talking an increase of government of a disproportional amount, because there are a series of advantages associated to having, for example, a healthcare system for everybody that would reduce costs, that would make it more effective, that would sort of compensate the higher spending.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of it, to me, making sure everyone had coverage and preventative care, and that's one of the parts of Obamacare that I'm happy with, is that it gets a measure of preventative care, so you may stave off some of those really expensive things down the road. But don't you think, going back to this debate here, it's really about diminishing and minimizing our expectations of our government and our political class when you say we can't think big things, we can't solve big problems anymore? And, immediately I'm thinking back, the space race to building the highway system, doing the electrification, phone lines in every house, all of those things that we did as a nation, it's telling us we can't do those big things anymore. At least that's the way I see it.
It's worse. We cannot, think of what you just said. Several of these things are related to infrastructure. So it's not so much that we cannot build the highway system. We cannot even pay enough to keep it more or less in reasonable shape. The Association of Engineers has every so often a report saying how much is needed to maintain infrastructure in this country. And we're falling short. They had a calculation a few years back. It was something like...
$3.6 trillion.
Exactly, up to 2020, I think. And we're short by more than $1.5 trillion of that amount of money. And so we're not getting even close to maintaining the infrastructure. We have pipes that are rusting, with, for example, that's part of the problem, and it's not the only problem, but, it's part of the problem in Flint, and, which we poison kids.
Yep.
Because we have rusted pipes.
But
this is unbelievable.
It is unbelievable.
We cannot if you're going to think of bigger, we relatively poor countries compared to us have a rail system that works. We can't even think of fast rail. It's unthinkable, the stuff that they have in Europe, that they have in Japan, that they have in Russia. So it's an amazing thing that.
But for me, Mateus,
we cannot think, not even going to space. We cannot think of doing relatively simple things.
Right, but here for me, it's been a 30-year attack on our government to get us used to being, and I can't tell you how many bumper stickers I see, don't steal, the government doesn't like competition, and all of these things that talk about how ineffective and how slow and how destructive, and it's all government bad, private sector good. And to me, it really has done an amazing job of taking a generation and saying we can't, as a society, collectively do anything big, be it roads and bridges or space or healthcare or education or any of that stuff. That's what scares me.
And it's also a policy of miseducation. I think you're right about that, but it's also a policy of miseducation, this notion that only the private sector can do. For example, that's typical of what fuels the Trump sort of campaign. He's actually a very failed businessman. He has not done well. He probably lost money over his career. But because he's in the private sector, he's been a successful case. So what's his success? He inherited money. And the government, although it does, a lot of what we see as, for example, people talk about the Google car, and I think I already talked about this in your program, but it's worth remembering. The Google car comes from a challenge done by DARPA, the defense research sort of arm of the Defense Department, who basically paid significant amounts of money to say, can you build a car that, you know, drives itself through this sort of, you know, challenging sort of place. And what Google did is, after several teams trying to do that, they hired the best guys with the best projects, and they privatized, if you want, this public sort of project. And it's, you know, doing well, but, you know, the notion, oh, Google came up with this. No, it didn't. It was the U.S. government, and it funded a good chunk of the research for that. And now the private benefits of that are going to be basically, you know, privatized by a, you know, by a big private corporation. And so, which, you know, on some level is fine. You have an American corporation that is globally competitive, and so that's fine. But so that's a way of doing industrial policy, and that's an important thing for the government to do. So big government is still part of big and efficient government. It's part of several things that people perceive as being the private sector. The problem is that a lot of that, it's corporate welfare, and we don't give the equivalent sort of treatment to poor people, to the people that really need the most.
I'm with you. I mean, at the end of the day, I can't tell you how many conversations I've had with someone who go, well, you know, I was behind somebody in line, and they talk about a welfare story, and they're usually anecdotal. And I say, you know, to be honest, if there is someone at the bottom who's cheating a penny or two here or there to put food on the table, I'm not as upset about that as I am about these corporate criminals who are just robbing us blind in the billions. Not a scrap of bread, but the whole damn loaf. That's what infuriates me.
Sure, sure. Regarding this criticism of the Ben Sanders programs, I should say, too, that a lot of the economists that are saying this sort of thing were economists that participated in the Clinton administration in the 90s, that they were for the regulation of financial markets. They got several things wrong back then. And so there's suggestions that they are serious people that should be taken seriously, whereas some of the people that are advising Bernie Sanders are people that were against the regulation of financial markets, that suggested that this would lead to a collapse of the economy as it did in 2008, seems disingenuous at best. So, So these people, by the way, in favor of them, all of them, you know, the ones that were in Clinton administration and then in the Obama administration, have come forward in favor of government spending, the policies during the Obama administration that allowed for a recovery. Some of them wanted even more. For example, Christina Romer was the chairwoman of the Council of Economic Advisors during beginning of the Obama administration. She wanted a bigger fiscal package. She wanted to spend $1.5 or $1.6 trillion, and that ended up being half to $800 billion because of political pressures, because of Larry Summers and stuff like that. So at the end of the day, there are reasonable people that are on our side, so to speak, progressive at this point, but their use of these arguments as saying that nothing else can be done is very dangerous for progressives. I think as progressives, we have to, as you said, we have to recover the notion that the government can do stuff, that the government actually has been doing stuff, that it's quite efficient. The government also can screw things up.
Yep. You know,
that's for sure.
As can private corporations.
Right. But, you know, the government can do things right, and we should try to do the things, you know, that are right, in particular for the people that need the most.
Yeah, I mean, for me, there are things government should do, and there are things they shouldn't. I mean, they shouldn't be making T-shirts and tennis shoes and that kind of stuff, but they should be making sure that every kid has an opportunity at an education. They should be making sure that everyone has access to good quality health care. Those just seem to be no-brainers to me.
And those are not utopias. That's the other thing. So those are not things that, you know, you can say that a candidate that says those things is not being serious. Those are perfectly reasonable things to assume are possible in our society.
Absolutely. And at the end of this, when you say we can't change, we can't do things better, like as it appears that these folks are saying, that what we have is all we're going to get and be happy with that, that's where I have a problem. Because look, I know people who live in other countries who have single payer, this kind of universal care where everybody gets care. And it's in my view, it's not any more expensive, and I would argue in some cases it's even cheaper. Yes, they pay higher taxes, but they're also not self-rationing health care because they're underinsured, their deductibles are through the roof, or heaven forbid,
sure,
they don't have insurance at all.
The cost, man. The cost, the, you know, there's two, you know, there is this paper that shows that, you know, Canadians, the cost of the Canadian system, you know, they spend on administrative costs 16% of the health spending. In the U.S., it's more than 30%. So just there you have 16% of savings on the functioning of the system. Because, you know, look, and I'm citing this number because that goes to the heart of who is efficient. So in the U.S., it's the private sector. And to administrate the system, they charge you more than 30%. In an equivalent system that it's public in Canada, you pay half that. So that's brutal. You know, yeah. That tells you how efficient the government can be if it does the things right.
Well, I mean, the numbers they throw out for Medicare, I think it's, what, 3%?
Yeah, exactly. There you go. You know?
Which is why
Medicare for all is not a bad idea.
It's not. And I said from the very beginning, which the folks that are being quoted in all of this and thrown around are people who said from the beginning it really couldn't happen. I said we've already got a system in place. The infrastructure is there. All you have to do is open it up, affix a price to it. Let me buy it. You're in so love with the private market. You think competition is good. Let me choose between the public plan and the private plan. To me, that should have been the minimum.
Yeah, exactly.
Just that simple. So last question I have on this, you know, in looking at this line of attack, do you think this is one of those things that could tear apart the Democratic side of this aisle, or is this something that just kind of floats away?
I think it eventually will float away. I mean, Hillary runs a risk, I think. She will, obviously, the most idealistic of particularly young people that are really for, you know, these big transformations, you know, they want to think big. They might not come to the polls in November. But I don't think the vast majority of people, I don't think that most people, you know, one of the things that Sanders, hopefully he will win, I mean, I should say, my personal view, but if he doesn't, he certainly has pushed Hillary to the left, and that's in itself an important thing to do. And so I don't think that would change too much the perspectives of the Democrats, but there is a danger of particularly on the younger sort of end of the coalition to lose some votes. I don't think it's sufficient necessarily to completely break the Democratic coalition. But you know, one has to remember that Democrats tend to win when we have big turnouts. So a coalition that it's you know, fired up, that can think big, actually might be more electable in November than one that it's you know, trying to just preserve the institutions of the New Deal something along those lines,
so, and expand
so
it.
Not dream bigger, but just survive the onslaught of conservatives.
I mean, for me, the reason I'm thrilled that Sanders is in this, and I'm with you, I hope he wins, is that he actually gets how do you negotiate. You start off with the big dream, with the big idea, and you become, you know, you figure out what you can do and where, which is why I'm thrilled to see that he is pulling Hillary to the left a little bit. But for me, it always comes back to the Harry Truman quote. Give a voter the choice between a Republican and a Democrat that acts like a Republican, and he's always going to vote for the Republican. It's that simple.
Yep.
Mateus, I appreciate the time, man. Look forward to talking to you again next week.
Sounds good, man.
All right, thanks so much.
Later.
Let's take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.